Hi, Marco Werman here. Before we get to the show, time is running out to make your gift before our fundraiser ends on December 31st. If you've already donated to our nonprofit newsroom this year, thank you. You make it possible for us to do this very important work, to bring human-centered coverage from all around the globe to your ears every single weekday, to bring you stories straight from lived experience from the people who are impacted the most, and to broaden your horizons and keep you connected to the world beyond our borders. If you have not given yet, this is your chance. By making a gift, you're not only helping our newsroom flourish, you're also paying it forward for your fellow listeners who are not in a position to donate right now. Please make your gift today to sustain our nonprofit newsroom. You can head to theworld.org/give to donate and learn more. That's theworld.org/give. Now, the show. The world mourns Desmond Tutu. One doctor in South Africa looks back on the Archbishop's fight against challenges everywhere, from racial injustice to HIV.
He just covered every big issue in the world and did it with such humility and with such humor, and was just a truly remarkable human being.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, the U.S. will ban products made by forced labor in parts of China. Human rights advocates praise the move.
It really shifts the burden on the companies to prove that goods are not made with forced labor.
They also wonder how it'll be enforced. And if you want to learn a new language, try singing it. It may come easier than poring over conjugations. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Cape Town, South Africa today, the bells are tolling for Archbishop Desmond Tutu, a giant in the fight for racial equality, a fight that he began in South Africa, but which reverberated around the world. Archbishop Tutu died at his home over the weekend. He was 90 years old. The Archbishop was instrumental in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. Once apartheid was dismantled, Archbishop Tutu was selected to head the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, pioneering the concept of restorative justice. With us to talk about his legacy is William Gumede. He's the executive chairperson of the Democracy Works Foundation in South Africa. He joins us from Johannesburg. William, you knew the Archbishop personally and worked with him. How will you remember him?
For me, I remember him for his caring nature. I remember him for, providing us with the moral leadership and the spiritual leadership for the struggle. Now, what Desmond Tutu did, he provided an alternative. You know, he was a principled nonviolence person, and he believed that nonviolence as an option to overthrow the apartheid regime is very, very crucial.
I mean, with a violent policy like apartheid, though, I'm wondering what Archbishop Tutu actually did to help accelerate the fall of the apartheid regime when he was taking that nonviolent kind of approach. What role did he play?
He played quite a number of roles. The very first one, of course, has been really to be there for people in their pain, in their suffering, you know, when they lost loved ones. The second one was that he, in the 1970s and 1980s, when the ANC was banned and other liberation movements were banned.
The African National Congress.
Yeah, when the African National Congress was banned and other liberation movements were banned and the leaders like Nelson Mandela were in prison, he provided the alternative leadership at home. That was quite crucial. And then thirdly, also, he also provided the leadership abroad. He was one of the most traveled South Africans in the 1970s and 1980s. And wherever he went, he campaigned for the isolation of the apartheid government. And that was an important leadership role.
Archbishop Tutu was also known for heading the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or TRC, under the first post-apartheid South African president, Nelson Mandela. Many credited the TRC for keeping South Africa from communal violence, even worse. What was the full significance of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
I want to argue that we had substantial acknowledgements of what happened. So no one, really, if you were a white South African, could say they didn't know after the Truth Commission, because, you know, before that, there was a blanket sense among many white South Africans that, you know, they didn't know what was happening. And secondly, also the Truth Commission exposed that apartheid was a system. It was not just a few rotten apples from the security forces who unleashed brutality. It was a system, you know, a totalitarian system where the state, business, civil society, sports organizations all colluded to exclude and to oppress Black South Africans.
As far as what Archbishop Desmond Tutu was able to do with restorative justice in South Africa, do you feel like it has a place today in other parts of the world?
You know, I think this is a South African example. It's not perfect, of course, but it really is an important model for other countries. So for countries following long periods of human rights abuses and conflict, civil war, it's a restorative justice, I think, is a very, very important approach to deal, to hold perpetrators accountable, to uncover the truth and bring justice to the victims. Now, I think perhaps the weaknesses of the South African Truth Commission, I mean, there are lessons from that. I think the first thing is that obviously we didn't get the full truth, the entire truth. And that was a real weakness. I mean, the last white state president of South Africa, F.W. de Klerk, died very recently. And I think one of the disappointments for Desmond Tutu was this: de Klerk never provided a full truth of what happened. And that is an important part of restorative justice, to get the full truth.
The U.S. never had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission after slavery. Would Desmond Tutu have said that at some point it's too late for restorative justice?
You know, it is never too late for restorative justice. And I know, you know, the difficulties of truth commissions so long after the fact. Restorative justice, it does provide, I think, dignity to the victims and their descendants. And just the fact that it also acknowledges the wrong, and maybe that's even more important, the acknowledgement of the wrong that has been done. So even if it's not a fully fledged truth commission, but the idea of acknowledging wrong that has been done and then linking that acknowledgement to some kind of formal reparations. And it doesn't have to be monetary reparations. It could be memorials. It could be, I mean, restoring the names of people. It could be restoring the reputations of the victims.
William, I think many of us who are not South African have an image of Archbishop Desmond Tutu, that wide smile, first of all, his wisdom and morality and that empathy we're talking about. So how do you think both South Africans and the world should remember Archbishop Desmond Tutu?
I think we should remember him as a person who always prioritized peaceful means to bring an end to conflict rather than violence. The second one, you know, is a person who was inclusive. I mean, most of our societies around the world are ethnically diverse societies, in Africa, in many developing countries, and also, of course, in the US, these are very ethnically diverse societies. And he emphasized inclusivity, that in any country that is diverse, no one single ethnic group or color or religion should dominate. You know, in order to get prosperous and peaceful societies, we have to govern our diverse countries in very inclusive ways. But I think for me, most important, that he offered a much more soft kind of leadership, a leadership that from the heart, a leadership that emphasized vulnerability, you know, leading true vulnerability, and leading to care by caring and true empathy.
William Gumede is the executive chairperson of the Democracy Works Foundation in South Africa. He's been speaking with us from Johannesburg. William, thank you very much for your thoughts and memories of Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
You're welcome.
The Beatles sang a few songs in German. BTS sings in Japanese as well as their native Korean. Opera singers, a lot of Italian to belt out. So is singing in a foreign language actually easier than speaking it? An artist from Taiwan has put this theory to the test. Patrick Cox has a story.
Wen Hao-tien was born in Taiwan and has lived in the U.S. for 33 years, much of that time in Boston.
My parents used to visit me from Taiwan, And the first thing they would do when they arrive is to take the subway and go to Chinatown.
They'd go to a grocery store and buy a ton of food. Tian remembers the last time they did this, not long before her father died.
I was in my apartment and it was getting dark. So I look out the window. I saw two old people. Both of them carried as many bags as they can possibly carry on both hands.
She knew it was her parents because of the bags. That Chinese grocery store, like many others, used red plastic shopping bags.
So like a gigantic balloon on both hands. So that's my kind of last memory of my parents visiting me from far away. And the image of them carrying many, many red plastic bags. So I have a feeling for the bags.
Tian filed this in the back of her mind for years. Recently, she was commissioned to put together an exhibit at the Pow Art Center in Boston, just a couple of blocks from where her parents would shop for groceries. She started thinking about the red plastic bags again. And so she made a dress out of about 35 of those bags, stitched and branded together in the style of a ball gown. The dress became a focal point of the exhibit, whose theme was living away from your homeland, recalling its shapes and smells and tastes. But what about the sound of the homeland? Tian wanted to explore that too. She started inviting people from as many parts of the world as she could find to teach her songs from their homelands. There was a Dutch-Indonesian song.
Waarom hel je toch nona? Money.
A Sanskrit chant, a Shaker hymn, a French song.
J'ai demandé à la lune, et le soleil ne le sait pas.
And the Happy Birthday song, sung in Brazilian Portuguese, which Tian now considers far superior to any other version.
Parabéns pra você, nesta data querida.
Singing is enhanced communication.
This is William Beeman, Emeritus Professor of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota. He says singing may involve mouthing a succession of words, just like speaking. But he says it's not even close to the same thing as speaking.
When you sing, when you break into song, you're actually overflowing with emotional feeling.
Beeman knows this in a personal way. As well as his career in academia, he was an opera singer for a time. Yes, that's him. Beeman says learning to sing can be a bit like becoming a young child again.
The first thing that a teacher has to do in order to be able to get a person to sing is to kind of regress them to the time when they were 4 or 5 years old and could sing freely and openly without any inhibition.
Which is also what Wenhao Tian is tapping into in her Teach Me Your Song project. The songs tend to be old ones, learned at a young age.
Do you want to learn the whole song?
No, maybe just teach me a part that you think I can learn.
Great, okay.
We're at Boston's Pow Art Center for another teaching session. We're in a room that's displaying some of Tian's art, including the dress made of red plastic bags. Today's lesson is harder than most. It's an aria from Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. The teacher, Susie Hamill, is drawing on her experience as a one-time opera singer.
So let's just say it like, por G amor, por G amor, qual te restauro,
qual te restauro.
Yeah, perfect. There we go. That's it.
A few more rehearsals and then...
Ready?
By now, Hamill has changed her costume. With Tian's permission, she's put on the red plastic dress. Tian thinks it would add to the sense of performance. She's right. You can hear the dress as Hamill moves about the room. As it turns out, Tian has made another dress out of red plastic bags. She hopes to give that one to Boston's new mayor, Michelle Wu. Like Tian, Wu was born to Taiwanese parents. For the world, I'm Patrick Cox.
That story came to us from the podcast About Language subtitle. Coming up in a few on the show, ants can teach us a lot about how we live on planet Earth. Thanks to the pioneering science done by biologist E.O. Wilson, we'll remember what he did. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The Biden administration will soon block goods from being sold in the U.S. if they're made by forced labor in China's Xinjiang region. Some of the banned products will likely include cotton, tomato paste, and parts for solar panels. The World's Anna Kuzma reports how the long-awaited legislation is a targeted attempt to address human rights abuses in China.
The government hasn't said exactly how it will enforce the new Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act. But what is clear, says Uyghur human rights lawyer Rehan Asset, is the onus will be on companies to prove their supply chains are clean.
I think it really shifts the burden on the companies to prove by clear and convincing evidence that goods are not made with forced labor. And that high bar is, you know, I think it's a right tone.
Asset lives in the U.S., but her brother is currently in one of Xinjiang's many internment camps for Uyghurs, a predominantly Muslim ethnic minority in China.
They're not just stories. These are human beings, families. Their lives are impacted by this.
The Chinese government says the region's labor program, which estimates suggest includes at least 100,000 people, is a way to reduce poverty and unemployment. But contemporary slavery researcher Laura Murphy has found the people in this program are forced to take part.
We have found that most products that are manufactured or grown in Xinjiang are made with some level of coercion, some level of forced labor.
Murphy has spent the last 2 years investigating supply chains in Xinjiang at Sheffield Hallam University in the UK. She says she thinks most Americans would be surprised to know the variety of products involved.
We know that 85% of China's cotton comes from Xinjiang. 20% of China's aluminum comes from Xinjiang. We have identified 3,300 apparel factories in Xinjiang.
Murphy's latest report found Walmart, Gap, Macy's, and many others source material from the region. The new law was introduced by Republican Senator Marco Rubio. Here he is earlier this month.
If you are a company who makes things or sources material from these parts of China, you're going to have to prove that slaves didn't make it before you can bring it into this country.
The bill is seen by many as a way to specifically target human rights abuses in Xinjiang while preserving a dialogue on other issues, says James Millward, a Xinjiang expert at Georgetown University. This is a departure from Trump-era import tariffs that penalized all Chinese products.
What the U.S. has been saying is we're willing to compartmentalize, even though we are appalled by what's going on in Xinjiang. We recognize how important China is.
Millward says forced labor has become a focus in the U.S. campaign against human rights abuses in China, partly because it's easier to target with legislation, like this new law.
There are, in fact, already laws on the books in the United States against importing products made with slave labor. And so this, of course, makes it very easy, or relatively easy, to respond to this particular part of the complex of horrible things that are going on in Xinjiang.
That complex, as he puts it, includes internment camps holding more than 1 million Uyghur people and forced assimilation laws that target Uyghur language and culture. After Biden signed the bill, Chinese government spokesman Xu Guixiang responded at a press conference in Beijing. Here he is with translation by state-owned China Global Television Network.
This is not the first time that the U.S. has implemented such a law. The real aim is to target China by disrupting the development of Xinjiang, destabilize it, and contain China's development. They have now gone to the extremes of desperation and madness.
Human rights and labor advocates say they'll be watching the U.S. government closely to see how the law is enforced and how companies respond. For The World, I'm Anna Kusmer.
Imagine if half the world were set aside for plants and animals, totally human-free zones. That is the half-Earth concept espoused by the famous biologist and naturalist E.O. Wilson. Wilson died yesterday. He was 92. His ideas will live on, including his pioneering work in sociobiology. That's a study of how evolution shapes animal behavior. Gonzalo Girabet is the director of the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard and was one of Wilson's close scientific colleagues. Gonzalo, what was one of Wilson's first big ideas that was really a breakthrough for the global scientific community?
It had a lot of very big ideas. I think the one that resonates the most with me ECs, island biogeography theories, right? These are very early ecological theories about how many animals can islands sustain. And islands have always been used as natural laboratories, right? They're reduced ecosystems with smaller land, fewer species, so it's easier to count things. And he did some pioneering experiments when they went to some tiny mangrove islands in the Caribbean and remove all the insects from there, and then they counted how many arrived through the year. So these are types of experiments that are impossible to do on a mainland, for example. Probably his most cited work, I would say.
So I wanted to ask you about E.O. Wilson's half-Earth concept. Explain what it is and why it's important.
Yeah. So he wrote the book Half-Earth, where he's, I think it's a bit utopic, and he knows that, right? It's about, if we could preserve half of the Earth, we will ensure that a lot of our biodiversity that we have today will persist. And he's always argued that we cannot just support the individual organisms, right? Like the species in zoos and things like that. We have to preserve the entire ecosystem.
I mean, in that sense, was he warning the rest of us to be careful?
Yeah, he has done that in several other books, right? His book also, where he's trying to reach out to the religious community and say, we all need to do this together, right? Let's not divide between the scientists and the religious people. Let's all get together and try to grow in the same direction.
One other thing, E.O. Wilson's personal scientific research focused on ants. What do you think led him from working on ant behavior to these bigger, far-reaching ideas like the half-Earth concept?
Many of these things are interconnected, right? As you start studying the ants that are restricted to just one rainforest in this part of the world, the ants that are invasive and are killing other ants, you realize that some are going extinct, that some are being replaced. And I think that if you really care about your organisms, you end up caring about the entire ecosystem.
Gonzalo, you met with Edward Wilson just a month ago. What did you two talk about?
You know, the last time I saw him in person, we had lunch 2 years ago before COVID almost, and he's really interested in expeditions, in discovering new things. And I mentioned that we are planning a future expedition to Cuba. And he's like, oh, I want to come. It's like, okay, we'll see. We'll make it happen, right? And he was so excited at the age of 92 on, you know, coming to an expedition to the field to collect ants in Cuba. He always wanted to do that, and he was never able to do it. So he had that energy.
Sharp and curious to the very end, huh?
Yeah, very much.
Gonzalo Giribet is the director of the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard and was a close scientific colleague of the famous biologist and naturalist Edward O. Wilson, who died yesterday. Gonzalo, thank you very much for helping us remember E.O. Wilson.
Thank you very much for making him being remembered by everyone.
You're listening to The World. 30 years ago, the Soviet Union collapsed.
In Moscow, the hammer and sickle is lowered for the last time, and an era comes to an end.
Today, we look back at a remarkable moment in modern history, the end of communism across the Soviet Empire, and reviewing another year defined by the pandemic. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The Omicron strain of the coronavirus was first identified in Pretoria, South Africa, last month. And ever since, hospitals across South Africa have been inundated with COVID patients. But recently, the number of Omicron cases has been dropping there. To understand more about what this important news might suggest, we have Fareed Abdullah with us. He's in Pretoria, where he works as an infectious disease doctor at Steve Biko Academic Hospital. Doctor, we do know that Omicron is very infectious. Can I ask you, first of all, what it's been like for you and the hospital staff dealing with just the speed of infection of Omicron these past few weeks?
The highly contagious nature of this variant just took us all by surprise. I mean, within 4 weeks, we were at the peak of our epidemic. And, you know, within days, the hospital started filling up. So our first reaction was just terror, really. We had a bad third wave with Delta. And with Omicron, we thought we would be completely overwhelmed. Everybody in Pretoria was getting infected, our families, our friends, and a lot of the hospital staff were getting infected with Omicron.
What scenarios were concerning you, and what kind of changes did your hospital have to make to deal with Omicron?
Well, the first thing we had to do was to quickly reposition many of the hospital beds to COVID beds and to shift the staff around. We had to gear up our emergency department to receive large numbers of patients. So we had tents put in on the parking lot at the emergency area. We had to scale up our testing to make sure that everybody who came through the doors was tested. But the scale at which Omicron spread took us all by surprise, as it did the world, I think.
I understand that with Delta, you did not have enough beds and had to actually turn patients away.
So Delta was causing a much more severe disease. We even had some of our own nursing staff in our hospital being cared for. What we had to do was to select patients who were most severely ill, and we had to turn away patients who we thought could manage on home oxygen. Those were tough choices to make, because it's very hard to turn away someone who's short of breath, you know, and you know clearly would benefit from oxygen. But when you have to start choosing patients, that's really becomes not the kind of medicine that one wants to practice. But we had a limited number of beds and equipment. So that Delta wave was really terrible, because everybody who came in through our doors had severe disease, and every single COVID bed in the hospital was full, and we needed more.
So what do you make of the initial findings that the virulence of Omicron does not appear to be so severe?
We wanted to be cautious about, you know, calling it mild disease. This virus has surprised all of us. It's been unpredictable. Now, 5 weeks after Omicron, we have a better picture of what's going on. And the first thing is the number of cases, the spread of the infection is coming down as fast as it went up. So that's very different, a much shorter period with a lot of infection. More importantly, fewer deaths. So Omicron, is, at least in our setting, has less severity than our previous waves. I think if we had had another severe fourth wave, you know, it would have been catastrophic.
What advice do you have for other countries that are now dealing with a rapid increase of Omicron cases?
So I think the most important thing is to understand that we can't show scientifically that the Omicron variant is intrinsically less virulent. The reason we've had a milder wave is because there's been a lot of prior infection, which offers up some level of immunity. And then we've had some success with our vaccination program. Those are the things which have provided some sort of protective barrier. So my advice to any country is not to think that Omicron is going to be milder, because the numbers will be greater, which means that the numbers of severely ill will be greater. And your only protection is to do as much as you can to vaccinate as many people as you can. You know, that's the simple strategy, a way of controlling the mortality from this epidemic.
Finally, Doctor, people in South Africa, people worldwide, are mourning the death of Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He famously helped to erase the stigma of HIV and AIDS. I wonder if you can speak to his legacy for a moment.
Well, I've been very fortunate to have met Desmond Tutu many times in my work as an HIV clinician and in the struggle for liberation. I mean, this man was really on the level of a true humanitarian, who showed that the true Christian way was to accept everybody, to stand strong for justice. Desmond Tutu was truly, with Nelson Mandela, you know, one of the two fathers of our nation, and it's just been so difficult to hear of his passing. Right. I mean, he just covered every big issue in the world and, you know, did it with such humility and with such humor, and it was just a truly remarkable human being.
Fareed Abdullah is an infectious disease doctor at Steve Biko Academic Hospital in Pretoria, South Africa. Doctor, thank you very much for your time, and thank you for your thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
2021 was another year dominated by COVID-19. Sometimes it might seem like we're right back at square one in our battle against the coronavirus, but there have been noticeable differences when it comes to how we respond to the pandemic. We asked sociologist Zeynep Tufekci to help us see the big picture from the past year. Zeynep is a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and writes frequently about the pandemic.
When history books look at 2021, it's going to be seen as both an amazing time for the advances in science with the therapeutics, with the vaccines, but also a massive failure because we somehow did not manage to take that technology and science and scale it up so we could vaccinate the whole world much quicker. And then we'd be looking at the end of the pandemic.
So once 2021 got rolling, what were the biggest game changers that came along this past year? Was it the vaccines or the variants like Alpha, Delta, Omicron, or is it a bit of both?
One game changer, of course, was Delta, because it was even more transmissible and it was also likely more severe. And the other game changer was the game we did not change, the vaccines, as great as they are, as amazing they are. We didn't produce enough of them quickly. I still don't understand why, as soon as it became clear in earlier 2020, when these were going to work really well, that there wasn't some global meeting to try to say, we are going to take every last vat and we're just going to build as much capacity as we can, because it would take 3 to 6 months just to do that. So that, you know, spring of 2020, we're going to have, you know, 7 billion doses. And then, you know, a month later, we're going to have another 7 billion or 2 months later. Because vaccine production is difficult. It's not easy to just sort of snap your fingers and get production next week. But it's doable. But we didn't really do it. We just let the few companies produce as much as they can. So what you would have needed would be a governmental global intervention to say, we're going to make sure there's technology transfer, there is new production lines. So I think that's the story of 2021. We have a lot of tools now, which is great. And I think 2022 is going to be a much better year because of that. But historically speaking, I will never understand why we did not finish 2020 with this grand plan to vaccinate the whole world in 2021.
Well, I know those kind of structures that lead to inequity concerned you a year ago. So as 2020 came to a close, what were some of your other big concerns about the pandemic in 2021 that you have seen come to pass, either negative or positive developments?
The one part that I worried about, vaccine hesitancy and vaccine uptake and mistrust in society, it was much worse than I thought it would be. I mean, things are better. We have a lot more tools, but the way we use them and how we use them and, you know, our relationship with convincing people that, you know, here's how you use these tools and what they do, I think those are really lacking still. And that's the problem with the whole response to the pandemic, is that even when we get tools, we don't really get all the benefit we could out of them if we were functioning better.
I mean, even people who behave responsibly, they've gotten their vaccine, they stayed masked indoors, they do feel confused at times. What lessons do you think we've genuinely taken on board this year? And by we, I mean the general public, public health officials, scientists, I mean, lessons that have stuck.
What this shows is that we're in this together. Like, behaving responsibly as a person doesn't get us out of this. What we need is a comprehensive approach that helps get all of us out of this. That means we have to make sure that vaccines are both available more and that more people accept them and take them and develop more methods of both convincing people and occasionally, when appropriate, mandating them. It means that we need to make sure things like just stay home as a slogan don't really work, because millions of people have to go to work. They're the frontline essential workers. So we need to make sure their workplace conditions are safe, that they have proper ventilation, air filtration, the kind of masks they need, paid sick leave, all those things. So I think in many ways, the pandemic has shown us the limits of, I will do the right thing and be spared the consequences of a society that's not functioning well. That unfortunately does not work well. That doesn't mean that behaving responsibly isn't a good thing. I commend people who do behave responsibly and do their best. But in the end, clearly, that's just not enough to get us out of what is essentially a societal problem. And I think that's the big lesson of the pandemic. There has been a major erosion in our capacity as a society to respond to a threat collectively. And that's the one that is going to haunt us if we don't deal with it, because yes, pandemic is terrible and it's one problem, but a lot of other issues we face, from climate change to inequality to you name it, also respond collective response. So I think of the pandemic like a stress test that has shown us a lot of fractures and broken things that even after we get through this, we are going to have to figure out a way to deal with it. Because, you know, if you're on the Titanic, maybe some people have money and they have a first class ticket, and maybe some people are behaving very responsibly, but you're still on the Titanic.
I'm speaking with sociologist and New York Times columnist Zeynep Tufekci. So, Zeynep, do you see that crucial lesson being acted upon in the coming year? I mean, more available vaccines, getting people to take them, facing the actual reality on the ground, what the pandemic means.
I'm not sure that we're going to do all the right things. I think the pandemic will eventually peter out from its acute crisis phase, partly by lots of people unfortunately getting infected or, you know, getting sick or dying when it could have been avoided, which is really tragic. But our institutions have lost a lot of trust, and they need to find an environment where they can regain that trust. We need to figure out how to deal with the media, social media, digital platforms, and all those things that have made it really difficult to deal with these problems. And it's like all of them have kind of combined to degrade the response we could have had to this pandemic. And I'm not sure we're going to solve them before the pandemic ends, unfortunately. But what I'm really, really hoping is that we don't just then go, okay, this crisis is over, and ignore all the things that have been revealed, because there will be other crises. Mm. And the very factors that have hobbled our pandemic response are going to come back and hurt us, all of us. Nietzsche has a saying, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, in a particular context. And with the pandemic, people started saying what doesn't kill you first will mutate and come back and kill you next time, as a gallows humor kind of joke. And I think the second has a lot of truth to it. What hobbled our pandemic response, the same dynamics will hobble our response to all these societal challenges, from climate to inequality to other things.
Well, to that point, Zeynep, and one thing that occurs to me is that we are not as afraid as we were a year ago on many levels. I mean, many of us are less cautious. We now go out to restaurants, masks perhaps. A columnist recently compared us to people watching a horror movie, saying, when you've watched a killer jump out brandishing a weapon 10 times, even when you've watched him kill, it just doesn't freak you out the same way. I'm wondering what that sort of numbing has meant, and what will it mean going forward?
Well, I mean, in some sense, though, we're not just watching the killer brandish the knife. We have a shield, right? We have vaccines in most of the world, and we have, you know, a better understanding of airborne transmission. We can wear bear masks. So there's all sorts of ways in which I think we can individually protect ourselves better and do a lot of things that, yeah, were difficult last year. We can meet, we can get together, we can do all sorts of things because, you know, we are better protected. What I don't want us to become numb to is to have gone through a year globally where more people died globally after a vaccine was available. I mean, that is just a striking, horrific thought that so many people died. And yes, in wealthy countries, part of this was people refused to take the vaccine, and there's a lot of propaganda and misinformation. In a lot of other countries, there were no vaccines available. I mean, at every level, this is a major failure that more people died after we had an effective, amazing, wonderful set of vaccines.
Zeynep, what are the burning questions on your mind for 2022? What are you going to be looking out for?
So there's a lot of positive lessons we can learn. We need to have the WHO function globally and much better. They need to be funded and supported, and they need to be better. We need our public health agencies to work better. We need to pay our doctors and nurses and all the health workers much better and have more of them, because clearly the moment there's a surge, we just lean on them. And you can't keep doing that. Like, there's all these things, the way we fund healthcare, there's so many lessons that I think we'll be working through for many years. But in the long run, what you try to forget doesn't necessarily forget you. And then it comes back and haunts you. So that's my hope going forward, is that we're finally going to enter a post-pandemic phase, if you will, at some point. And I would like that to be a turning point for the better, rather than let's just not think about it till the problems come back and bite us again.
Author Zeynep Tufekci writes the newsletter Insight. She's also a columnist with the New York Times. Always good to speak with you, Zeynep. Thanks so much for taking a look at the past year with us.
Same. Thank you for inviting me again.
The World's End of Year playlist is full of songs that helped me stay positive in 2021. Some are from artists we've spoken with on the show, but 2021 is also the year that I went back to vinyl and picked up some classic releases like the 1969 self-titled album by Brazilian singer Gal Costa. Every time I put it on, it just makes me feel better. Find her song Que Pena, a duet with Caetano Veloso, and other recommendations from our newsroom, all on our 2021 playlist. We've linked to it on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. The system was supposed to last forever until it didn't. Communism, the system of the Soviet Union. Sunday marked 30 years since its collapse.
In Moscow, the hammer and sickle is lowered for the last time, and an era comes to an end.
The red Soviet flag was lowered from the Kremlin and replaced by the modern Russian flag in white, blue, and red. Just a couple of days before that, Mikhail Gorbachev had announced his resignation, and U.S. President George H.W. Bush addressed the nation.
This is a day of great hope for all Americans. Our enemies have become our partners, committed to building democratic and civil societies.
Yevgenia Albats was in Moscow throughout that period. Today, she's the chief editor of the Russian news publication, The New Times magazine. Yevgenia joins us now from Moscow. I mean, just listening to those words from President George H.W. Bush, he elicits the U.S. and USSR as former enemies and the hope of two democratic civil societies growing in tandem. I'm really curious to know what strikes you hearing that today.
Thank you very much for having me, Mark. I guess, on the one hand, you know, I remember back then in December of 1991, I felt quite sad. After all, I grew up in the Soviet Union. I was born in the Soviet Union. I was Soviet. I never was considered Russian. I'm not ethnically Russian. I'm not Russian Orthodox. I'm Jewish. And therefore, it was very perplexing. Secondary, I had quite a few friends in the now former republics of the Soviet Union, in Georgia, in Ukraine, and many others. And it was hard to comprehend what kind of relationship we were going to have. Thirdly, I was upset that the dissolution of the Soviet Union was done in the most undemocratic fashion. No one asked us, citizens of the Soviet Union, whether we wanted this or we didn't want that. It was all sort of done in the worst clandestine, you know, I would say Soviet manner, just a covert operation which was conducted, and we were just witnesses to it. That's all. That was our role.
I mean, that's really interesting because the sense that I recall from the time is that the world thought, well, of course, the Soviet Union is ready to shed communism.
Listen, shared communism was one thing. However, the dissolution of the Soviet Union was something very different. Just think about this, Marka. Just imagine for a sec that you live in Washington, D.C., in the United States of America, and all of a sudden, President Bush or whoever announced to you that your country no longer exists, that California became independent, Texas went to Mexico, and then, no, Vermont became part of Canada. Just imagine this for a sec. Soviet Union was my motherland. My grandfather was killed by Stalinist NKVD people. He was pronounced the enemy of the state. My father fought for his Soviet motherland with Germans. My mom was there on the frontiers during the World War II. So anyway, back in 1991, Soviet Union was my home. And I was citizen of the Soviet Union, not of, you know, some imaginary Russian. For you, we all were Russians. However, it was very, very strange feeling to people like me. No, I wasn't Russian. And my friends were not many of them. They were of different ethnicities and religions. And they didn't want to be understood as just Russians. So it's not that simple.
What I'm hearing is that sounds like you lost your country. Of course, it's a process of dissolution that stretched out over many years. What were the key factors, do you think, that ended the Soviet Union?
First of all, the Soviet Union was an empire, and as any empire, it was doomed to lose resources and power to pay to its henchmen for loyalty. It lost any resources to pay to police, to army, to KGB, etc. So it was doomed to fail. In a way, the same process happened to France and to Great Britain. That was the collapse of the empire. And for people in Eastern Europe, it was really a moment to celebrate because they got back their independence.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. I mean, a lot of people in the West, after the Soviet collapse and the end of the Cold War, thought that democracy would naturally flourish. And in general, the future just looked really hopeful. For you personally, what did those following years in Russia feel like?
At the very beginning, it was awesome. It was marvelous because a lot of our hives got opened. And since I was covering KGB since 1987, it allowed me to get access to the wealth of documents that were hidden. It was marvelous in terms of journalism. It was very free. It was hard to leave, but, you know, it was the best reporting one could have.
And when did it stop being so marvelous?
It became much harder by the end of 1990s. However, in 2000, when Boris Yeltsin chose as his successor the former KGB apparatchik, Vladimir Putin, that was the end of the story. Putin was a disaster. He was a disaster not because of he himself, but because of the institution that he represented. As a result, it wasn't just one KGB guy who got into power. The whole corporation of the most repressive institution of the Soviet Union, the KGB, got into power.
Do you believe that Russia has come to terms with its Soviet past?
No. No, so Russia didn't come to terms with the Soviet past because much of their archives are still closed. Much of the history of the Soviet Union, especially the black sides of its history, still are not available to the majority of the population. Kids in schools are taught the same myths about Russia and the Soviet Union as it was under Soviets. Vladimir Putin himself says that Ukraine as a separate nation never existed and they're just part of Russia. So, no. And that's the problem, that, you know, the politics of memory, they were used by Putin and his pals as justification for these anti-Western rhetoric. So, unfortunately, we are back on the same road that we were in early 1980s. We're in an unfree country, which is running on myths based on the Soviet victory in the World War II. That's what I was taught when I was a kid. And now kids the age of my grandchildren are taught exactly the same myths.
Yevgenia Albats is the chief editor of the Russian news publication The New Times Magazine, speaking with us about 30 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Yevgenia, thank you very much for the conversation.
Thank you.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.